what's important to you? What would it look like? You know, I really believe that when we are so lost, we don't even know what happiness, what would that look like? I don't even know what makes me happy anymore. And to re-explore that and to be willing to say, I'm okay with not knowing, but I'm here for the journey, you know? And sometimes it's just allowing that process to happen.
Welcome to Backseat Driver, the podcast hosted by two practicing psychotherapists, where we boil down years of experience with clients young and old to teach you how to do the what to do to improve your life and relationships.
I'm Mark Yamada, clinical psychologist in Seattle.
And I'm Nikki Bennett, licensed clinical social worker in Salt Lake City.
Well, I'm so grateful this morning to have our next guest on, Annette Klingler, who I met about 10 years ago, I think. Annette, this has just been a dream of mine to do some kind of work with you because your story is so inspiring. And I'm just really excited for our audience to hear from you this morning. I think we can all learn so much. So if you just start out by sharing your story with us, that'd be fantastic.
All right. Thanks, Nikki. No, I can't believe 10 years. I laugh because I think back when we met and our lives, both of our lives look very different now. And too.
Yes, they do.
Children, school, work, you know, all those things, life. And kind of where do I begin? Well, it started out in 2007. So about 13 years ago is really where the big story changed. I had just had I was pregnant with my second child, thought it was a full-term healthy girl. And I was in a midwifery women's health program at the University of Utah, decided to go with a midwife. And we had just relocated to a new state, so switching doctors is never fun. And some things got missed. And the next thing I knew, I had a 3.5-pound baby boy with a genetic defect. And we lost him 17 days later. So that became the start of this kind of whirlwind when life changed kind of forever for us. Obviously, to hold your child, and we got to bring him home and to have them pass it in your arms is traumatic in itself. But 6 weeks later, I could have never imagined that. I was driving home. I live in Utah at the time, up in Park City, and I was driving home with my little girl. And a lady crossed the median and hit another vehicle on the interstate. And my daughter, my little girl, who was 3.5, Alexis, was killed instantly. And I sustained pretty life-threatening severe injuries. I lost my arm in the accident, had a traumatic brain injury. One of those moments, though, I look back and think, I was also very lucky. Life Flight had actually been already on the mountain. The person had had a heart attack and they didn't need him, obviously, anymore. He had passed. And because they were there, they were able to jump in to an ambulance, grab me, take me a mile down the canyon, and Life Flight me to the hospital. So that was kind of the beginning of the end.
And then I remember that time so vividly, and I hadn't met you yet, but I remember hearing your story and just feeling just this heart-wrenching grief, even just hearing that story.
It was one of those, it was a high-profile case. It was during what we call Sundance, so the interstate had been closed. So yeah, it was, ended up becoming very news, all over the news and stuff like that. So I was surprised. Obviously, I didn't know it at the time. But
well, I remember the way I heard was that we had a mutual friend, and that's how I'd heard it. And so we had been praying about you or for you for a long time before you and I actually met. But what were those days and weeks and months like of just that excruciating agony, and how did you get past it?
You know, I remember waking up in and out of the hospital, trying to put two and two together of what was going on. It was thoughts are, did I do something? Are people mad at me? But I don't know. I just was trying. I knew that there must have been a trauma or something, and I couldn't remember. And my sister-in-law had come in and said, oh, I made Alexis's bows. And so as I'm going down my checklist in my head, I'm intubated at the time. I'm in and out of consciousness. My check mark was, okay, she's okay. And come to find out later on, those bows were made for her memorial. As I sat in the hospital room, my biggest thing was I remember kind of coming to and looking down at my arm and realizing my arm wasn't there. And I kind of laugh about it today. My family looks at me like, what? Because I went, they're like, well, you lost your arm, the da 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 da. And I went, huh. And in my heart and in my soul, I went, huh, okay. Kind of like next. Mm. And I think, who thinks, huh, you lost your arm? You know, so on that aspect, it was one of those, it wasn't a huge thing. And even just emotionally, I think to myself, like there's the other part of me goes, hello, you just lost your arm, you know. But yeah. You know, anyway, but I hadn't put together that I had lost Alexis. And I couldn't figure out, my parents were there and my mom came in. And I, again, I'm intubated, but I'm more conscious. I couldn't figure out why they hadn't been there, but why the little ones hadn't gone. And I'm trying to draw like baby, an A, and my mom walked out of the door, out of the room, hospital room. Jesus. And it was that moment life stopped. I mean, it did. She was my everything. And my mom walked in and said, honey, we've told you several times, she's not here. She didn't make it. And from that point, within 24 hours, so that was about a week after my accident, that I finally consciously realized what happened. And I ended up going into a coma for another week. And that time my family knew that I was done. Nothing had medically changed. I just didn't want to be there anymore. And I had, during that time, I actually had coded for almost 5 minutes. And so I did have a life death experience. And without going into, it's a whole other big topic, but going into that, I was with my daughter and it was a life changing as a mom. I knew that her and my son were beyond okay. The peace that I felt was extraordinary. It was a calmness that this world just doesn't have. And I did have a conversation. I knew that the choice for them, it was their time and when they had went, but I knew at that moment I had the choice to stay or go. And I had done medical missions before that and thought she had basically persuaded. She was like, mom, you need to go and finish helping people and I'll see you in a little bit. And I, at that moment, I could hear, I could kind of feel a pull from the other side, so to speak. And it was my dad saying, you can't leave us. Your mom won't make this. And I could hear him yelling almost like kind of this, and realizing later it was because they were in the room where they were trying to revive me. And at that moment, I made the decision to stay. And that was really the start of the journey of where, you know, here I am 13 years later, because there were tender mercies with that. I literally woke up, I always say like 20 minutes after the episode. And again, I'm still intubated. And I laugh because I felt like this lady who should run down pews of church going, hallelujah. Like, it was very simple. I was like, we're only supposed to be here for a little while. We have things to do. And then we get to go. And it's like, it was just, the plan was simple. And I was ecstatic to know I had peace in my heart. And until later on, that was a tender mercy. But then I realized later on, I wanted that peace back. And that was a hard place to be. So
I can only imagine what it was like for you. How long were you in the hospital?
So I was in the hospital for about 7 weeks. I ended up switching hospitals. I received great care. They saved my life in one. but it was a teaching hospital. And so they missed a lot of things because they didn't really coordinate care with one another. So I ended up going to another hospital that I actually was supposed to start working the very next day previous to my accident. And with that, I had lost all my health insurance and because I wasn't working. And at the time, and it was just those tender mercies of they transferred me and took care of all of that. So, about 7 weeks.
Do you have grief counseling while you're in there? I mean, I remember honestly just being in tears, and of course I'm very empathic anyways. And I deal with anxiety. And so I remember just carrying this pit in my gut and just this heaviness thinking about you and how you could even. And Annette, this is the thing about you that's so incredible, is you haven't just survived, you have thrived. It's so incredible. I don't want to skip ahead too quickly, but
yeah,
I am also at the same time just so eager to
get
show
there.
Our listeners how resilient the human spirit is, particularly
is.
Yours. But did you have counseling? How did you get through the emotional piece?
At the time, in the hospital, I did not. I had some church members and family, you know, I had a lot of support. It was a high media case, so they actually would not allow a lot of people in. People had actually tried to sneak in our room, different things, which I don't know why to this day.
Bizarre.
I look back and think that's weird. Okay, here's a lady with a, you know, why would, anyway. But, you know, I had a few people who came up that I didn't know. I do remember, like, I lived in Park City at the time, and it's still a small community, and some people had started when they found out, like, our health insurance at that time, before you could have universal insurance, I had carried it. My husband had been a business owner, so I always carried our health insurance for our family. So they did some big fundraising things, and it was, you know, I think that's where it kind of got media stuff out. But on the therapy side, I will be honest, I emotionally felt good while I was in the hospital because of that experience.
Incredible.
With Alexis. However, going home was a different thing because I don't think it was real yet. I don't think it had really hit that when I go home, she won't be there, so to speak.
And having just buried your baby, did you say 6 weeks earlier or 13 weeks earlier now?
I had been, you know, I had just had a baby, all of those kind of hormones, all of that, just trying to kind of heal from that aspect. So I think the first few months, it was definitely a time of numbness. So my accident was in January and they had decided to hold off on a memorial and for funeral services because they decided they needed to know whether I was going to be there or not, whether they were holding two or one. And by that May, we had planned a beautiful service for her. And I say it's on Cinco de Mayo. So there you go. She was our little wild girl. And no, this was our fun one. And we always laugh saying, you know, she lived life. She was that old soul. She'd be like, Mommy, I don't want to be a nurse like you. I want to be a race car driver and a doctor. You know, I mean, she just was that way.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was just, but I do remember I stood, it was the day of her memorial and I had her picture in my hand for the first time it hit. I didn't want to be there. And I was mad. I was mad at God. I was mad at just the world. At that moment, I think that's really where life had crashed down. So I did start some counseling. It wasn't really formal. It was through a friend I knew through church, so it is, and stuff. Because the next hit was by July, they realized I couldn't have any more children. They said I had a head injury. Now I had pituitary damage. And they said, you're in menopause at 30 or at 29 years old. And I thought, joke on me. I just remember walking out going, are you kidding me? Like, I couldn't believe
insult to injury.
It was completely. So what did I do? I'm kind of one of those, like, all right, what are we going to do with this? I knew I was like, Heavenly Father, you can't let me be a mom and then take it all back.
So my faith was a strong thing. It was one of those kind of tender mercies, I will be honest. My sister-in-law, she had had three kiddos, and her and her husband came to me and she said, let me be a surrogate. And we started that process, did this whole, because they look at it as a legal thing, this whole legal, and by the time they did the medical, they found she had stage 4 ovarian cancer, undiagnosed. Oh, she had to have a total hysterectomy. And I again went, great, I'm so happy we saved your life. But, you know, so it was those moments of like despair of like, you just get a glimpse of hope and it was gone. And at that time, I really did hit that point of, I'll be honest, kind of one of those driving up the canyon and this little sports car going, I don't care if I die. Going, this is the deal. I was praying and saying, if you want me to stay here, I made the decision to stay here. You better make me a mom. I don't know how else to say it. My mom would always say, you never tell Heavenly Father, you know, you never demand. And I was like, at that moment, it was.
You're doing my shoes, Mom.
Yeah. I'm like, and anyway, we did infertility, met a specialist, and on that following Christmas Eve, I found out I was pregnant. And it was beyond odds because they said, you know what, we, after testing all this, they said, we really don't think this is going to work. And so that was my first tender, like that's what kept me going. So we go through that phase. And during that time, I hit about 25 weeks and went into heart failure. And started having edema. The doctors didn't know why. And I ended up having our little guy at 29 weeks during those 4 weeks in the hospital. If everybody remembers the 08 market crash, financially, we basically lost everything. Our business was gone. My now ex-husband had made some investments in real estate from, you know, basically our insurance settlement and stuff for the accident. And everything literally was, I went to fly my mom out to the hospital and it was one of those moments of, he was like, watch what you spend. And I went, what do you mean? You know? And so that was the first time realizing my career was gone. My children were gone. And my now to be ex-husband kind of had checked out of our marriage. So realizing at that moment in the hospital that I was going to be probably a single mom. So that was, you know, I tell my now 12-year-old that he was definitely my gift. He's on the autism spectrum and I think he needed me as much as I needed him. And we tease each other. I'm like, you are my handful. And Heavenly Father knew that I would love you and I needed you and I wouldn't send you back. Anyway. But no, the darkness definitely came, you know. But I also had realized that my two other ones didn't get the chance to make the choice to live. And I did. And I think it was my worst fear of letting them down. Kind of the repercussions of if I took more actions, to be honest, in my hand. And out of all things at that time, I actually saw Oprah sitting by myself. And people asked me what was a pivotal moment. And it was a mom who had lost. It was like a retake 5 years later. And it was a mom who her ex-husband had killed their two children and then himself saying, if I can't have them, neither can you. And she was so broken. And I connected with that person on that part of the video of going, she lost everything that mattered. And it was the recap 5 years later that she had made the decision. She said, okay, I'll give you 3 months to not do anything. Basically to herself. And 5 years later, she had been remarried and had children again. And obviously life had changed, but I could tell that there was a sense of peace and happiness. And I went, okay, kind of sounds silly, but I was like, I'll give it 3 months. You know, it was one of those kind of step by step. Later on, actually, Oprah had found out about that. I don't know how, somebody had contacted her about my story, and I wouldn't go on. It was like her last year. And because I wasn't at that point of, I was like, yeah, I'm here. I'm alive. I'm existing. And I didn't want to be the sad story of like somebody listening to it that day going, okay, I won't complain. My life isn't that bad. I felt like there had to be the other side. I hadn't been on the other side yet. I hadn't found that place of happiness or inspiration. And I was like, that's not the story I want to tell. Anyways, to jump forward, I found myself as a single one-arm unemployed chubby girl. I laughed. I had been always very active. And I was on all this meds, and I literally didn't recognize myself. And kind of laugh and go, I didn't have anything left. Though I had to move back home from Utah to Puyallup, Washington, where my parents were. People talk how resilient I am. I couldn't even at that time make my own doctor's appointment. People talk about that I'm resilient, and I literally had to look at my mom and say, I have this 14-month-old and I'm literally just here. I was alive. I hadn't died, but I definitely couldn't really emotionally or physically do anything for myself at that time.
I would imagine, like, obviously your grief is excruciating at that time and probably depression. Did you feel anxious as well that, hey, now here I've been blessed with this little boy, am I going to lose him too? Or did that not show up for you?
You know, to be really honest, so I had done testing because there was a court case. Anyway, it was on the road design. I'll just put an insert. There was no money involved. It was about about how they designed roads. So, but because of that, they had done testing and they realized I was probably at a fifth grade level cognitively. Wow. And I think of it as emotionally, I was checked out, but I was on so many pain medications, to be really honest, and so many things that they were like, this will help you, that I think I was emotionally just numb. But my worst fear, I'll be honest, going through a divorce at that time, was that I would lose my little guy. And so I actually didn't seek counseling because I saw that as a weakness. So my ex-husband at that time had a son from a previous marriage, and we actually had to go through a huge custody battle with him. We had ended up having full custody of him, and I saw what that looked like. And I was mortified because I knew if I lost him, I couldn't. There was no hope for myself. Kind of, I will be honest. Yeah. He was my reason for being at that moment. And so I did. I didn't go to counseling. And I'll be honest, it emotionally, it took so much. Where do you start? And I felt like there were so many layers of, I was grieving the loss of my children, but I hadn't even grieved the loss. I felt very victim, like I felt like a victim. And I don't like to think of myself that way, but I was like, how can somebody hurt you so bad, you know, at that time, that's supposed to love you, so to speak, and or who had gone through experiences that nobody else would understand. So I felt like there was a lack of connection with anybody else. But I did. I didn't go through therapy for, to be honest, a couple of years, which is a scary, I think back, don't recommend that. I actually highly recommend saying, you know what, I see that as that it would be a smarter thing to go to therapy if there was ever a core issue, saying, hey, I'm doing what I need to do to take care of myself. So don't recommend the other that route. And we'll definitely say there had to be a process of learning to grieve each part, each loss. There was that, the physical self, which to grieve about losing my arm or the physical things that I used to be able to do, that wasn't even an option because the grief of losing the children were so great. And I felt like it was very selfish, I'll be honest. And then later on, it was that loss of the family unit that, you know, there was nothing worse than a holiday weekend, knowing that that's when you normally go and do something with your family. And I didn't have one. Yes, I had my little boy, but it wasn't, you know, and so that was a really tough place to be at. And as I kind of worked through that, I end up leaving my parents' place. They're very rural. And so I was like, okay, I need some socialization. And I literally, it was step by step. I started going to, you know, I went to church. I was like the only single mom where I went to church at that had kids, that was by myself. So I felt like it was definitely a disconnect there a little bit. Those little things. And
how long after you moved in with your parents did you move out? Because you mentioned you were at a fifth grade level. I would imagine you regained some of your cognition, or did you go off the meds, or how did you find the independence to be able to do that? And how long was it?
So I realized really quickly with my medical background. So I'd obviously been, I'd been in a master's level and finishing my last semester as a women's health practitioner. And I was like, I can't think. And I remember going, yes, I'm depressed, but I'm depressed because I'm tired. And people would go, well, honey, you're tired because of this, this, and that. So I actually only stayed with my parents for about 4 months. And then I started looking at other medical issues. I realized really quickly that the cognition level was there. It just wasn't there at the time at 8 a.m. At 2 o'clock in the morning, I was the Nike commercial. I could do anything.
Wow.
So I realized, one, I went off of medication because I thought, I can't think. I would rather hurt than not think. And I mean, I did have to do some pain management stuff, but that was a huge issue. Second, I had to dive in. After doctor, I kept saying something's wrong. And they kept saying, no, you're tired because you're depressed. You've been had trauma. And sure enough, somebody did a sleep study and I had a form of narcolepsy from my car accident. I got that treated. And that's what drives me now for what I do. I got that treated and went, oh my goodness, the light turned on. Because at 2 a.m., if you were my friend, I would say, yes, let's go do something tomorrow, or at 10 a.m. But come morning, I couldn't do it. And then you're depressed because you let people down. You're not getting out there socially or physically, you know, just all of meeting all those needs for yourself. And so that was a huge thing of making sure. And again, I wonder how the average person without my medical background would navigate that. Because I honestly felt like I, you know, just knowing something wasn't right and pushing that was a huge breakthrough for myself. And during that time, I'll be honest, it was a very enlightened spiritual time for me. It was the very first time, I've always been a go-getter, that I had to just be and not just exist, but just be okay where I was. That I wasn't chasing the next career. I wasn't chasing, I could just be a mom. I realized my son had some little things. And at first everybody put it off too. He was 29 weeks. I realized that something wasn't right. So again, he was diagnosed with autism, you know, and so that was a focus, during that time. And, but that's, I look at this time of place of nobody could have fixed me. I think it was a process of, in mental health, we talk about like the whole health wheel or things like that. I literally created the spiritual side. I had to create that community, that sense of community. I started taking physical health because I do feel like you could go to therapy for a long time, but I don't think that cognitive level would have changed if I hadn't addressed the medical issues that I was having. You know, I did things like CrossFit, and here I was the one-armed chubby girl in CrossFit, and they're all very fit, it was very intimidating. And the next minute I was like, I couldn't do a push-up with two hands, but now I was doing it with one. There was finding that new sense of what I could do. And the next big thing was for me, it was an epiphany moment during that time. My mom had come to me and said, I always felt a very spiritual connection, especially with my daughter, and said, she can't do the things she needs to do on the other side until she knows you're okay. And I realized at that moment, I think as a mom, you never want to feel like we're supposed to help our children. We're not impeding them. You know, we're not. And I went, whoa. And I also realized at that moment that happiness was a choice. Because I think before, again, I just kind of existed, but it was the difference of you go from existing to, okay, this is what life happened. What do you do with it? And I always think I was probably the girl who was more the cup is half empty, not half full. You know, it just, that's kind of, even though I was kind of that very go-getter kind of personality, I probably.
That actually really shocks me about you.
That's it. See, and that's where most people, my husband would laugh now because he's like, oh, that's totally you. But because I realize, and that's where I feel like that resilience factor has nothing to do with me. It has nothing to do with my story. It has the fact that I was a human being and life happened and I could have, for me, you couldn't have taken any more. I lost my family. I lost my career. I lost myself, my physical, emotional, spiritual. It was just everything that every part. I even realized at one point, my name wasn't mine. It's something my parents gave me. So you really, it goes down to really those core fundamental things. And of course for me, spirituality, my spiritual thoughts were huge. And so I was like, okay, God, this is Heavenly Father. This is where I am. You know, what do you want me to do with this? And to let that molding kind of start to take shape. And that's when I met you. I was.
How long after the accident was that, Annette? Because you were living back down in Utah, right?
It wasn't. I actually was visiting because my ex-husband would take our visitation with my son during the summers. And I would stay in Park City during that time. And I, you were doing a talk and a good friend of mine at her house. And so I was invited to join. And that's where I met you. So
and
I'll
never forget seeing you. Like in the whole audience, you just, the whole time I was speaking, I was just drawn to you the entire time. And then I met you after and realized, holy cow, this is the woman I've been praying for a couple of years now. Incredible.
I had wrote on a slip, I actually have a little flyer that you have, and actually I have it in this little book because I wrote my next step. And I, what that meant, what that, but it was on your flyer. And it was while I was listening to you, it was that point of inspiration of like, you know, because you had talked about kind of, it was the idea that I realized really quickly, okay, plastic surgery, all these things for me, myself. I was like, I won't grow an arm back. I know that sounds funny, but I was like, no. Is it going to change? But I also realized that I think by human nature, I'll be honest, going into a dating realm, I wasn't interested. I also realized very quickly that people go, oh, there must be a story there. That must be uncomfortable. I'm not going to go there. And so those who knew me eventually were like, man, I don't even think of you not having an arm or something like that.
I remember going to the water park with you and here I am, you know, struggling with my kids who are probably 6 and 11 at the time. And you've got this baby and you're walking around with your keys in your hand and your bag on your shoulder and carrying a baby. And I'm like, okay, Nikki, buck up.
Can I tell you at that water park, I realized with my son, because being on the spectrum, he did not like water. So I remember taking him on the top of the slide going, we're going down, buddy. And it was one of those moments that I went down the water slide realizing I couldn't hold him and the thing at the side, the little, and we hit the bottom and I think we drowned each other. So there you go. Oh, it was, no, I laughed because I was like, okay, I didn't quite think about that. But, okay, I don't have an arm. First time I went swimming, I was in Hawaii, it was catamaran. I went, can I swim? you know, and it's those moments that you forget. But I'm amazed at what we can do when we have to. And again, it's not my story. It's just that human experience that, okay, I lost my dominant arm. I had to learn how, I literally would scribble with my left hand. I had to figure out how to shave my legs. I mean, very technical, how to put my hair. I can't put my hair in a ponytail. There you go. That, you know, but you figure out simple things, or how to cut a watermelon. You bring it home and you're like, huh, what was I thinking? You know?
But gosh, and if our listeners could see you, Annette, Annette is like so well put together, the hair, the makeup, she's fit, like all of it.
Well, and that's where I'm like, but you know, that's where I laugh because I'm so not. Anyway, you know, you try. But, you know, it's now jumping a little, you know, moving forward, I ended up dating a little bit and realized there was nothing wrong with people. And maybe I was just not 20 something anymore. So I also say, don't ever give up on yourself. I met my husband online because somebody else had made a profile thing for me and I was not interested. The next minute we talked and it was like 5 hours later. And I'll be honest, I had come to that place of, I knew I was going to move back to Utah. I did make the determination when Rylan was going into kindergarten, I was going to go and finish my degree as a nurse practitioner. And at that time I realized that I was going to go back in mental health. And I had worked with veterans and I had done equine psychotherapy. I'd always been into horses. And so I kind of thought, and I worked with injured veterans, newly injured, and realizing at that moment, it's kind of funny how you reflect upon yourself. It's that they're like, yeah, but this happened and this happened, or they had grief or, you know, guilt of survivor guilt. And it was like, wait a minute, you owe it to your buddies or whatever, and it's that camaraderie and they're like, oh yeah. So it was about 5 years and I wasn't interested in dating. But I did have, like I said, I had went on a couple of a few, but nobody had ever met Rylan. I was very protective. And again, here I meet somebody, they thought he lived in Utah. He didn't. I had had friends who'd end up checking him out before I ever made this phone call. Him and I talked online. Like, I was like all paranoid, but I also knew everything I had written. Somebody had told me, a wise man, I just say, make 10 attributes you would ever want in a partner and put it in your underwear drawer, so to speak. And when I read his profile, it literally, I was like, did he go and look in my underwear drawer? So there you go. No. and so when we talked,
checked all the boxes.
Yeah. I walked away out of that room and it was literally like on cloud nine. I was like, I met the man I'm going to marry, and I knew it. And within 5 months, to be honest, and 1,000 miles later, because he did not live in Utah, he ended up living in Las Vegas. We were married and it's been 7 years now. And I kind of jumping forward, I went back. I did some prereqs at the U to see, to be honest, I needed to see if I could go academically back to school. You know, living life was one thing, but could I deal, you know, could I really make it? I had this strong prompting that I was supposed to go back because of my high media case. One of the last articles was written was, she is determined after she takes some time for healing that she will go back and help people and finish her degree. And that was something I always kept on my wall. And I went back and finished. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner as of last October. I took boards and I'm actually in a doctorate program at the U. And between that time, I have two little ones. So I have a four-year-old. I kind of say we had a surprise. No, he was supposed to be here in the middle of my program. We have a two-year-old. So he was not expected. That's why I laughed going, I know you understand a little of that. I was like, wait a second.
Yes,
how did this happen?
I call ours our happy little accident. You know, after 10 years of infertility, to have a surprise was wow.
Yeah.
Not what I expected at 42.
My doctors were like, this isn't supposed to happen. And I was like, yeah, I understand that. So, and you know, life can, it's, I'm in a private practice. I also, work with, different populations a lot. But my business model now, it's called Resilient Minds RX, but it's, the whole point is that I try to tell my patients 13 years ago, if somebody had come back to me and said, your life can look different, that you'll be happy, and not just existing, I would have said, yay, good. I'm glad you feel that way. Good for you. And in my mind, I would have been murmuring jerk kind of, you know, I mean, honestly, like, and to know that just as human beings, we have the ability to feel so broken and so lost. And it, there are seasons, there are ebbs and flows, life still happens. And I can talk about this without totally getting emotional, but then I get emotional, you know, but it's just because life is hard today, it doesn't mean tomorrow will be that way. We just have to give it that chance, but it's also a choice at some point. When I talk about the cup is half full or half empty, I had to start turning my thoughts of, okay, this happened. You know, even with my ex-husband, I wasn't the one who had to have to knock on the door. I didn't have to drive past the accident site knowing my daughter was there, but, or do I rush to the hospital to see if my wife who's still living may make it? You know, so you learn to have empathy and compassion. And I think that it's all of those things that you, again, you realize that you can be broken, but sometimes the beauty in the process, I wouldn't change my life for what I have now. And even the losses, there's been beauty in the whole process of that. And again, I think 13 years ago, if somebody had said that to me, I would have been insulted completely. So, you know.
Passionate. I have goosebumps. My whole body is just feeling the truth in what you just said. And I'm sure our listeners too. What is the best thing to say to somebody who's been through unspeakable grief and loss? How do you treat your clients who come in? Do you still say that? Do you still say, if you can hold on, you will be happy again? Or...
So some beginner feel a lot of times they're like, yeah, you're not supposed to talk about yourself. And as I'm more on the
medical side. I run into that all the time.
I'm more on the medical side. So I laugh because I'm like, as I'm doing it, I'm like, because even on my page, I'm like, this is who I am. And sometimes they're like, but I haven't been through that. Or sometimes people will feel guilty because they're dealing with things and it's, they know that somebody else may have had it worse or some, whatever. And I'm like, first of all, throw that out the window, because that isn't, I did medical missions in Ethiopia. Are you kidding me? They lost children all the time. So if you want to start comparing, you know, like, so there's always somebody, so you have to give yourself that break and that chance. But I do, I'm very real. I tell them by the time they come to me, they are broken. They feel like I'm the last measure. Normally, and I just share, I don't do what I do because it's a career. I do what I do because it was a promise. I do what I do because I am now on this side that I can, I know that we don't have to just exist, that we can thrive, that we can live, and that it doesn't have to, we don't have to be in that dark hole. But it is a choice. And for me, I just tell them, let me prove it to you. Let's work through this. So that we can find that mind shift. And I, for me, I feel like being real and sharing those experiences, especially, you know, it's, they're like, okay, I think there's a truth there when somebody's been on the other side a little bit of saying, I'm still here. You can make it too, you know.
I totally agree. And, you know, that's something I ran into consistently in graduate school or with peers is never, never, never share your story with a client. And as I've learned and grown and practiced, the more I share my story, not to have them support me or help me, but in solidarity to say, yeah, I get it. That's where the magic happens, when we can have the courage to show up and own it all.
I couldn't agree more. It's you're sharing your story at that moment. It's not to help yourself or, like you said, to have empathy from them. It's showing, like you said, you get it. And sometimes knowing somebody's been in the struggle and that they've survived and that they're still, I don't know, that they're still here, that sometimes that's a big thing, that, okay, somebody understands where I'm at and will fight for me to feel better or to not, you know, because I definitely had hurdles along the way. And to say to my patients, I'm not giving up on this. This is why I do what I do. And we're going to figure this out. So.
And it gives them something to really relate to, that traditionally, you know, the way that therapy, you know, has developed has been to keep a very solid boundary between personal and professional. And I think what we're finding is that, you know, human beings, we're always evolving, and we're realizing that some of the things that we've done in the past may have been for that time and that season, but people really need a deep connection. And sometimes it's not even what we say, but it's just the fact that you were there.
Exactly. No.
Sometimes that's the only person they have to connect with.
You know, I work with a lot of men, and it's not easy for them to express emotion. And when I'm talking about, like, kind of the career loss or something like that, it's those moments that they're like, you get that, you know? And I think that there's so many ways, again, that, you know, there's this facade, like you get that social media thing and it's out there, but it's still distant. It is, I think, that we lack those moments of connections. And I think that's vitally important, you know? And so for myself and my, you know, and then I tell them I'm selfish and they look at me and go, what? I said, because I'm keeping my promise and that makes me happy. So there you go. I am good. I don't need you. And thank you. And, you know, in that aspect. And I think that there's a truth to that too. You know, when they're like, okay, I'll hold you to that. So
Annette, what would you say to the younger Annette? And what do you say to your clients? What would you tell her? Anything different than you did at the time?
You know, like I've said before, I said, it's not my story. It's kind of more of that humanistic one. You know, it's kind of, I look back and I think nobody really could have said, again, if they told me that it was going to be better, I probably wouldn't have believed it. And I tell my patients that. It's that moments of, because when you're in that place, it's just words. And so I do think that we have to give ourselves that time and that, and know, but I think that we all need hope to think that it can change. And so I do, I think that knowing that somebody has gone through something, again, like I said, of saying, okay, you can be this lost, you can be this broken. Life still happens, right? You know, the house can still explode. My children can be running over, you know, it's chaos and mess. And I'm thinking, and then I went, oh wait, I used to pay for this every day, you know, those moments. But that there are seasons, there is a time to grieve. Nobody could have fast forwarded it. Nobody could have fixed it for me. I don't even think there, you know, daily therapy, all that. I think it truly was taking each piece and truly rebuilding. And I do a lot of this with patients. It's like their first time we meet. It's like, what's important to you? What would it look like? You know, I really believe that when we are so lost, we don't even know what happiness, what would that look like? I don't even know what makes me happy anymore. And to re-explore that and to be willing to say, I'm okay with not knowing, but I'm here for the journey, you know? And sometimes it's just allowing that process to happen.
And realizing that that itself is a choice.
Exactly. And I, if somebody has been with me, I say, you know, you just made the huge choice to be here. Because I understand how emotionally exhausting, and the last thing we want to do when we are struggling is to go and talk to somebody that we don't know. We're nervous, we're anxious, and then to share our whole life story or and be like, okay, hope that you get something out. I mean, that is a very vulnerable place to be. You know, it sometimes we do have to strip off those layers. You know, there's little things that I have, those little triggers still. And that's why I say life happens, you know, and you have to go, wait a minute, where is that coming from? Or where's that emotional, you know, coming from? But I do think being excited that there's a new hope, that there can be a new happy. I could have never imagined my life 13 years ago of what I had now. That's my kind of my biggest point. I could have never imagined my 3 children and my husband did not exist 13 years ago. My career did not exist 13 years. And so to look at that 13 years ago, I could have never had the hope of what I have now because it wasn't there. There wasn't even, you know, a seed there that I think, oh, this is what it could look like. And so to not give up and think, well, how could this change? How could this be different? Because it can be very different. And you know, again, I will always miss, there's moments, you know, to know that I'll never be at my daughter's wedding, you know, or those high school graduation, you know, or her first time getting a car, all of those things. And that's because we love. And I would never, ever want to lose that part of it, though, because sometimes I really believe, though, the wounds that make us, they are our scars. But I also call, I'm like, the triumph over tragedy, it is the scars, I call them the warrior wounds, you know? I was like, I don't need to chase fixing this or that. Sometimes it's mine or external. You see more of my injury, but no one knows what somebody else is going through. But that's also those processes, those wounds that we're dealing with, make us who we are and shape that. And I truly believe that we can make that and take it. Someone else along the journey is gonna need that. And need that wisdom. It takes everybody. Nobody can make it on their own. And so I think it's just having the right people at the right time. And I think it's, and so, you know, when they look at me and they're like, wow, you're helping me out, you know, and I'm like, you never know 5 years from now, 10 years from 13 years, you know, the struggles you went are going through now could be life-saving for somebody else later.
I heard a quote and it was that I'm not who I am in spite of my struggles, I'm who I am because of them.
Exactly.
And that certainly is reflected in your story, Annette. What's next for you? You said you're going to get your PhD. I hadn't heard that yet. How exciting.
So I, I had an opportunity. I have known that one of those moments that you're like, I have little ones still, and it's the balance between mom, work, home, and life, and the door kind of opened, and I thought, no, but I'm finishing a doctoral dissertation at the University of Utah, and also doing like neuroimaging, but also in our field, we're, you know, in mental health, things are evolving as well. We have the biological basis, we have, yeah, I mean, there's just so many things that I really think that we have to look at when we're dealing with mental health at the whole person. And I think it's vitally important that we do that. Because for me, if I hadn't dealt with the medical condition, I can't imagine somebody without any medical background trying to navigate that. And things like that need to change. So I'm very passionate about making sure that there's access for mental health, those kind of things. You know, it's kind of like my medical missions in Ethiopia. I brought the medications from the US thinking I was going to give them all these things. And I walked into these pharmacies in the middle of nowhere, these tiny little huts, and they had every medication I had. the people just couldn't access it. They couldn't afford it. And so for me, it's a very passionate thing of what's the point of being America, to be honest, there you go, of without being able to make sure we can reach people that need it, that need the help when they, you know, that it's there for them. And again, I think that mental health is a full mental, it is that mind, body, spirit kind of approach. And when you, I think we kind of, in the medical field especially, categorize, we kind of forget that whole big picture. Sometimes I think it's easy to focus on just one little thing, and we really need to look at the whole person. And I think that's how you get real true healing too.
Absolutely.
Just taking it all in is quite awesome for me, in that, you know, and that you were talking about how you came to realize that no matter what things happen, no matter what losses we go through, your message is one of saying, even if I didn't realize it at the time, I have come to realize that nothing will ever take away that choice is always there. You may not always, I may not always realize that it's there in the midst of pain and suffering and loss, but if you wait and you listen and you do what you can to look up, you'll always be able to see it, hear it, or find it. And realizing then that at some future point, and not knowing that until that time in the future is actually long past, that I have become something that has blessed the life of somebody else. And whether that was ever the purpose or not may not really matter. What matters is that your own existence, that everybody's existence, has great value, even if you don't realize it in the moment. It really does, that we really cannot build the most fulfilling of lives without good connections. That's what I am feeling as I've been listening in on Annette's story, and just feeling very, very inspired that I want other people, Annette, I want you to know that I want other people to hear this story and to take that and have it help and bless their lives so that they can then tell their story to help themselves and other people.
Annette, I have to say, your story, you know, I love that you said Oprah asked you to go on and you thought, no, this isn't going to be my story, that I'm just one of those ladies that, oh, my life's not as bad as hers. It's like your story is so profound and it has such a huge impact, and it's a chapter. And what you're doing now is so incredible. I just, half this call, I've had goosebumps. You are so incredibly inspiring. How would somebody find you and learn more about the work that you do online? Do you have a website, or where would you direct our listeners?
So I do have a website. It's at resilientmindsrx.com. You can Google Annette Lowry Klingler. And you can find me as a provider as well. You know, I think the biggest take we all have is that our experiences are important. And again, never minimize your own and the trials that you've gone through, or that you're going through. There are seasons, you know, there was a time and place, even for loved ones, that when they're seeing somebody struggle, it doesn't have to be fixed today. It's a process, and providing support for those loved ones that are struggling, I think, is vitally important. And knowing that it's not their job also to just fix it. Because I also know that if you don't go through the pain, you can't really have true healing. I truly believe that you can't miss those steps along the way, unfortunately. I truly believe the pain, I have a theme that, you know, sometimes the hardest roads lead to beautiful destinations is what it is. And, you know, I think each one of us have the capability to do that. And I think that that's the powerful side of it. It's not just my story. It can be anybody's story, and that they have the capability of shaping it into something bigger than themselves.
And just such a message of hope that no matter your situation, it absolutely will get better if you can just hold on and breathe through it.
Definitely.
Thank you, Annette. My heart is beyond full.
Well, thank you.
I just can't thank you enough.
I can't thank you for this opportunity. For you guys to reach out and give me this opportunity to share this story 13 years later. I hope that it's not just the story of, oh, I'm glad I'm not her, somebody else's life is harder, that to be on the side of, you know, of happiness, that hopefully it can help somebody else if they're struggling in their own journey right now.
It's been an honor and a pleasure. Thank you so much for with us today.
Thank you.
And that's it for another Backseat Driver. If you found this podcast helpful, please share it with a friend.
We'd really appreciate it if you take a minute to rate and review our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.